Smithy.
One of the great things about being on the radio is people from past lives ring you up and say, ah, heard you on the wireless, or in my case now, saw you on the telly. And you get to catch up with people from many, many years ago. Now, many of you will remember last year I spoke with David Everett, the Special Air Service Regiment trained killer who went on the wrong side of the tracks, David Everett, and became Australia's most wanted criminal at one stage. He and I were in the same hut in 1978 when we joined the army. It was a fascinating thing to hear how he had gone off the rails. He followed his path after he left the Special Air Service Regiment. I followed mine. Mine went to the Victoria Police. And a bloke that I worked with at Collingwood Police Station, one of the real hard men of the Victorian coppers, Rod Curis, rang me up after all the kerfuffle of last week and wanted to just catch up. You never quite know where these conversations are going to go, but I'm going to have one with him fresh on the radio, the Savo. Rod Curis is on the blower. G'day, Rod.
Hey, yeah, Mick.
Mick, Jesus, been a while. I'm real well. Yourself?
Yeah, not bad.
That's the ticket. You can remember those days back in Collingwood?
Mate, I'll never forget the days at Collingwood. They're embedded in my mind.
It was a very hard training ground for young police. There was a hell of a lot of crime in that area in the 80s, including, of course, the Hoddle Street, Julian Knight, and that you'd have those memories burned indelibly.
Yes, well, I mean, it was an area where there was lots of high-rise commission flats and, you know, people that were less fortunate than probably you and I, and and some of those people unfortunately turned to crime as their means of support.
You went on to, you know, a stellar career in the armed robbery squad, and you're involved. Well, how many doors do you reckon you've kicked in pre-dawn?
Well, I thank you for saying it was a stellar career. I don't know about that. I think I did my job like every other guy in the squad, but I've kicked a fair few doors in my time.
And not knowing what's on the other side, Rod, what's going through your mind?
You know, you get trained by VicPol to do those jobs, and you know that the people you're working with are also trained to do it. So you know you're relying upon the team that you're with to help you out, but you know that the training will support you. Not just probably unlike the army, when you were in the army, you know, the quicker you get in and with the element of surprise, the better the odds are that everything's going to be resolved to the satisfaction of all.
When you're dealing with armed robbers, I mean, there's no bloody Pollyannas there. You're dealing with desperate, hardened criminals. You've had shots fired at you, haven't you?
Yeah, and funnily enough, it wasn't when I was at the armed robbery squad. It was when I was a junior constable at Flemington, responded to a call to an armed robbery, and the offender was a 60-year-old man who had a submachine gun in one hand and a pistol in the other, who had held up a bank, and he let rip with the submachine gun and fired some shots at me. So I have been on the other end of being shot at, and it's not a nice thing to happen to people. And obviously those things happen to people that are in banks and supermarkets and work on armoured cars. So, you know, there were a lot of guys there that were professional criminals. That was their day-to-day work. They would obviously look for opportunities to commit armed robberies. You know, the bigger the amount of money, the better. That's what they did for their living.
Armed robbery tends not to be an opportunistic, for those hardened, you know, crooks. It's not a crime of an opportunistic thing. I mean, it's a cased, planned, you know, a lot of them are meticulous, aren't they?
Of course. And as I said, you know, when they would often, I'd say the success rate of the squad was quite good. So most of the time we would apprehend the people responsible and they'd go away to jail. But when they got out, because it was the only thing that they knew, they would turn to looking at the next job and getting in contact with those people that they'd been in contact with before that might be out on the outside, try to find an opportunity that they could go off and exploit and go off and commit the armed robberies again, because realistically they needed money in a hurry. They could get a lot of money. Sometimes it was to fund other criminal enterprises such as drug trafficking.
Yeah.
But that was their job.
And that's planning. It's sitting off a place. It's looking where the cameras. Can you take us through that?
Well, you know, I suppose people think that, you know, they have the image of the movies where, you know, a bandit pulls up outside a bank and just runs in and screams very loudly and potentially puts some shots into the air and takes the money away. But you know, the average armed robbery on a sizable institution like a bank, they would spend, you know, 2 to 3 weeks looking at the comings and goings of people out of the bank, you know, what time people come. Because even after I left the squad, you know, some bandits moved to secreting themselves in the roofs of a bank. They would break in overnight, lift up the roof and go and hide themselves in the ceilings, and then drop in the morning before the bank was even opened and hold it up. So, you know, that's the level of planning that these guys would go to in order to obviously achieve their objectives.
After I left the job, you worked on one huge job, the big armour guard job out at Tullamarine, didn't you?
That's correct. Myself and my crew, Steve Brown was a sergeant. I'd ticked a job earlier when I was at the armed robbery squad. It was a theft of an armoured car down in Port Melbourne. Yeah. And I was lucky enough to get a break on that job through some information from an informer, and who told me the people that were responsible. And when we were able to locate them, lo and behold, they're in the middle of planning another armed robbery. And that was the job out at the airport. And we conducted many, many weeks of surveillance on those two people to try to find out what they were doing, because we didn't know exactly what it was at the time. And and then we utilised the services of the Special Operations Group in Victoria, which is our special response police, to apprehend them.
Rod, that ended tragically, didn't it?
Unfortunately, it did. A man by the name of Normie Lee was one of the armed robbers involved in that. You know, he was called upon by the Special Operations Group to stop and put his weapon down. Unfortunately, he didn't do that. He turned on them. And those split-second decisions that police have to make, and they're not decisions that police make lightly, but they have to make them. In that case, those police officers had to defend themselves, and it was a tragedy, but Normie Lee was shot and killed.
Yeah. Detectives spend a lot of time looking at video footage from security cameras and looking for patterns, crooks, known offenders and what have you. People think it's all kicking indoors and that, but there's a lot of research and, you know, looking for criminals turning up in places. So it is important that their faces are visible, is it not?
Oh, of course. You know, CCTV is a very large and I suppose integral part of our society in this day and age. One only has to look to London, where there are, I couldn't tell you the number of cameras that are around London, and they've solved some very, very heinous crimes over there. I talk about racial attacks in the street through their CCTV systems. And, you know, whether we like it or not, people would say that there's a Big Brother syndrome. But I think when you balance the security aspect and providing a safe and secure society in a large city to the detriment of maybe people thinking that their movements are being monitored, I think at the end of the day, you've got to say that I would rather live in a safe and secure city where I know that if CCTV either provides a deterrent to someone committing a crime or ultimately being able to apprehend a person responsible for a crime, then I think it's a good thing. Yeah. I know in Melbourne that they've got the Safe City program, which has helped out to a certain degree with the incidents at the nightclubs in Melbourne. But yeah. I think that, CCTV, it will never go away. It's not going to go backwards, so I think we need to embrace it.
I have in front of me at my desk a pile of media reports from around the world where known hardened criminals, and it's about a half-inch thick pile, have used this disguise of a Islamic burqa to make their way around unchallenged, including casing premises for armed robberies and also to escape after the event in a number of crimes. It seems to me to be a no-brainer that disguising your face in a fashion that is socially acceptable is going to make it a hell of a lot harder for police.
It does. I don't think you could dispute that. I know that from my perspective, I've got some legal training as well.
You have a Bachelor of Laws degree, don't you?
Yeah, there's issues about, about the law itself. I mean, you know, how does one law in Australia sit in hand with another law? And, you know, at the end of the day, our safety and security is paramount, and if people will use those types of means to get around things like CCTV, then you have to make a judgment about what is the greater good. Yeah. No one wants to impose unreasonable limitations on another person's religion or their culture. But at the end of the day, we live in the country that's Australia, and it's it's our society, and we need to obviously try to have everybody working together, but we still need to be safe and secure.
Rod Kiris, look, the community is immensely grateful for the work that you and your colleagues have done. Thanks for speaking with us.
Not a problem, Mick.
All the best. Yeah, you to your team, mate. We'll catch up shortly. Rod Kiris, one of the hard men of the Victoria Police Force, and you've heard his story.